Baby, it's cold outside.
Oh, for God's sake. Here we go.
Welcome to another instalment of the Chem & Em podcast with me, at C Stewart, SHS.
And me, Emma Kill, at Those That Can.
It's been a few weeks since we last caught up, Emma, particularly after our session with Fiona. So have you had any reflections on that since we last spoke?
Well, it's been an interesting one, hasn't it? Because I think Clemmie and I have disagreed on something for the first time.
Ooh. This is going, ooh.
And it's been interesting because we discussed whether teachers should actually express their political views online, teachers imposing their views on young people.
Definitely. And then I sent out a few tweets, as I always do, and I was absolutely amazed by the traction that it gained on Twitter, with quite a sense of passion on both sides, with some people arguing vociferously that people should be able to talk about their political leanings in their classrooms and on Twitter, with people knowing that they're educationalists and others quite fundamentally believing that shouldn't be the case. So where do you stand?
Well, I think people made the distinction, didn't they, between talking about it in the classroom and talking about it on Twitter. And there was quite a strong argument, I thought, that actually we are human beings first and we are entitled to private lives and views. And as long as those views aren't divisive or inciting hatred in any way, then why shouldn't teachers actually be free to say what they think about certain policies or the upcoming election on Twitter? I don't actually have an issue with that personally.
Whereas I do.
Oh, she's got beef.
Only a small little bit of beef jerky, because I think fundamentally teachers should teach children to question, be curious, ask those big questions about the world around them. But it is not the teacher's responsibility to tell them what they should and shouldn't believe in. And I think it's nigh on impossible to separate the person and the teacher from their political beliefs. So even if you think you're not showing any form of bias, you invariably will be through what you say and how you say it. And children do look up to us as teachers, most of them anyway. And they will start to absorb, even if they don't realise it, through their unconscious bias, what they should and shouldn't believe in. I remember saying on a previous podcast in the 97 election, going down for breakfast at school. Yes, I went to boarding school. And the headmaster coming up, putting his arm around me and saying, "It's a very black day." And I remember even at that age thinking, what a weird comment. Is I don't want to know that you think it's a black day. I want to work that out for myself. And I suppose that's always stayed with me.
See, it's really interesting. I mean, we'll say in a minute who we're here with, but it's interesting who we're here with, because actually my politics, I suppose, are so much a part of my DNA and my identity and who I am. And whilst I would never, ever, never have said to a student who I'm going to vote for,
no,
or even what party I'm going to vote for, I remember about the age of 8, the age of 9, talking to my dad about politics and what it meant to be left-wing, what it meant to be right-wing, and actually forming my own identity, having that discussion, having him explaining, but forming very much my own identity. And my memories of school aren't so much about teachers expressing their views, but about actually quite vociferous arguments in the sixth form common room and between different groups. Mm. So this was the Thatcher Kinnock era, when everything, I suppose, in some ways, was a lot more black and white, a lot clearer, the lines between left and right. And I remember those arguments quite fondly, though. They were debates. They were healthy debates. Mm. But I very much knew who I was and what I stood for.
That's so interesting. I was at quite a liberal school, and there was no conversation about politics ever, but we were made to sit down and write a letter to Amnesty International every Thursday before dinner if we wanted to earn our supper. Your face. Genuinely.
Is that political then? Would you see that as a political?
No, but I'd say it was enforcing your thought process on other people. And it made me think that I didn't appreciate being made to do that.
No, I was never made to do anything like that at school. I mean, we would segue quite easily between conversations about boobs and conversations about Thatcher. It was all
like many a man.
Like what?
Like many a man.
Like many.
Which is not go there.
And it was all just par for the course, really.
I think what is interesting is I was doing a session this week, no, not this week, last week, with one of the boys at my school doing some English work. And unfortunately, the conversation did segue onto the general election and the outcome. But he said, "Come on, Miss Stewart, who did you vote for?" And I said, "I couldn't possibly tell you that." And he said, what about Brexit? What did you vote for on that?" And I said, "I literally cannot tell you. It would be wrong of me to tell you." At which point he winked to me and said, "You're definitely a Remainer," which I just thought was brilliant. And I didn't dare unpick with him why he was so confident confident that I might or might not be a Remainer. But I just love the way he asked that question.
And he deduced.
He did. He inferred. And I don't know what evidence he used to base that on, but I'm fascinated. It did remind me of you know, many a conversation. This kind of links in beautifully to who we're going to be talking to today. I have been brought up in a house that fundamentally is not allowed to show bias, doesn't show bias, would never dream of showing bias politically. And I suppose maybe that's why I have such a strong backbone about that and my own beliefs. He is a broadcaster, has been working for 43 years, I found out this morning, and is an entire inspiration to me and our entire family. And therefore, he's very, very welcome to our podcast.
And he just happens to be your dad. Welcome, Alistair Stewart. I am delighted to meet you. And
it's a real, real pleasure to be here. I mean, just to sum up, I think where we may end up going, I wanted to join in the introduction when you were talking about Fiona and Camilla, both of whom I admire enormously. But I really admire open, honest, candid and strong debate, which you two are brilliant at.
Well, yeah, and this is precisely what this podcast is about. And I think we talked about this in the first podcast. I've been thinking about doing a podcast for some time since Jane Garvey, name check, from Woman's Hour, suggested I did one. Yes, I know I have to mention this every time I possibly can. I was thinking about talking to teachers about issues that we feel strongly about. And suddenly one day I was talking to Camilla Tominey by the football pitch, because football pitch is the great equaliser, watching the kids play. Yes, and the child is here waving in the background. She said I would pay to listen to you talk to Michael Gove. And she said, but seriously, why are you planning to talk to people you agree with about everything? So that candid debate. Yeah. And I think I've learned more from the four podcasts we've done so far.
Well, there were many standout moments, because I've listened to all of the podcasts up to now. But for me, one of the standout moments, A, because it was an incredibly strong point, but B, it summed up what you were doing, was Fiona Miller, Alistair Campbell's partner, who is one of the great campaigners for good comprehensive education, saying, why is it, well, say, oh, every prime minister since God knows when, and went to Oxford, and everybody who's running British business went to private school and what have you. And she said to you guys, what I really want is a kind of top 10 of the superstars, men and women, who went to comprehensive schools. That's not done. And it should be done. Because the label doesn't mean good or bad. It means systemic.
There's a challenge. Should we do that, Ken?
Yeah.
Done. That's our next job. Once you've got the TEDx talk and the marathon out of the way, we will compile.
She's so lazy, isn't she? I mean, Sally and I thought we did a good job bringing up, you know, take on board challenges. But, you know, running two schools, running a marathon, delivering a TEDx, and also a TEDx alongside her principal. I mean, what does she do?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, she obviously spends a lot of time on her nails, because her nails are looking gorgeous.
These are my Christmas nails, everyone.
Clemmie has Christmas nails. Can I just, Isla, could you describe Clemmie's Christmas nails for us, please?
Like Dorothy, I think, is what she wants to say.
Yeah. A bit like, well, what?
Like so, the red sparkles.
They are, like the red sparkles
from the Wizard of Oz. So clearly this is what Clemmie does all the time. But
with just a touch of Cruella de Vil as well.
This is school holiday nails. I had time to wake up, have breakfast and get my nails done all in the same day.
Alistair, what comes across in all of our interactions is your absolute pride in and love for your daughter. And it's incredibly moving. But what
and
was
three
she
brothers,
like?
And three brothers.
And three brothers. What was she like when she was little?
She screamed a lot and looked a little bit like a Mohican in the very early days,
which
she hates, and we tried to keep away from everybody.
My mum is going to kill him. Look at her face.
Alex came first, and there's a three-year gap between number one and number two. And I think one thing Sally and I remember very, very sharply from quite early on was how close they were. They're different characters. Alex can be very thoughtful, very quiet, very understated. Clemmie can be gregarious, bouncy, but both great intellects. And that I adored and loved very much. And one of my favourite photographs is the two of them at Clem's first day at Twyford School, she has a satchel that is one third of her entire size and bulk. But Alex standing very proudly next to her. And that has endured for over three decades, and I'm very, very proud of that. I had no idea she was going to be a teacher.
Right.
She was always gifted musically, and she got to Beedale's on a music scholarship. And I'll tell you the story briefly, because I know it can be edited, because we're in the hands of a brilliant professional. But Alex had a scholarship to Winchester, and Clem, perfectly reasonably, was keen to have a scholarship too, egalitarianism. Nothing wrong with that at all, but we may talk about it a little later on in a different yes, competition. And she did Cheltenham Ladies College, Down House, St Swithin's, and the Beedales cropped up. And she went along and auditioned for the music scholarship there and offered a piece on the piano and offered a piece on her violin. And I remember them saying, yeah, pretty good, but, you know, we're Beedales and we really are the best musically and in all performing arts.
No, how did you feel about that?
I batted my...
To be fair, my piano playing was quite village. It really was.
Village?
They then said...
One hand was much quicker than the other.
Do you have another instrument? And she said, no, those are my two. And the guy said, do you sing? And she said, yeah. And they said, well, we consider that an instrument. So then, without any preparation, delivered a piece and Julie got the scholarship there.
Oh.
So yeah, she's always been a performer. And I think, funnily enough, this is something that she and I have very much in common. And that is, if you are blessed, literally blessed,
yeah,
with a good functioning brain, but also a little bit of performance, you know,
yes,
then I think it can help if you want to be a newscaster, TV presenter, or a brilliant teacher.
Yes, yes. I mean, Clemmie has been threatening to do a little bit of singing for us, and I do feel that we need a couple of lines, because her vocal talent was clearly what got her into her prestigious school.
So, maybe later. Just, we'll see how we go.
Come on.
Maybe later.
Fly me to the moon.
I will not fly you to the moon.
She's gone all shy. And so when she was... I'm quite interested in the screaming, because I was a screamer too. My mum tells me she couldn't take me into a shop without me screaming the place down and people looking at her askance as if she was the worst mother in the world. What kinds of things made Clemmie scream?
Well, let's do a shout out for the NHS, because we had no idea. Sally had the experience of one child already, but this was new. And in the end, one evening was particularly bad, and we ended up in A&E. And in fact, it was an intestinal thing. There was a physiological problem that needed to be sorted out. So she was just incredibly uncomfortable. And what do children do when they're incredibly uncomfortable? They shout.
Right.
And Clem gives good shout.
Mm. I do. And interesting, I still get nervous tummy ache now. As a fully fledged adult who is doing quite well professionally, I still get nervous tummy ache. When I get nervous, I get...
That's because you take things seriously, though.
I take things very seriously.
Yeah, and I like that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wincing here because our daughter had a relatively minor procedure at Great Ormond Street the other day, and seeing your child helpless and in pain is really like nothing else. She's wanting to show you her wound. You're wanting to show your wound? I thought you were about to show your wound. But yes, all hail the NHS.
That empathy is also crucial in anybody who wants to be an educator, to be a teacher.
Mm.
And I'm a patron of Naomi House, which is our local hospice, and Clem's been involved in that off and on from way back. And I wrote something the other day saying that Naomi House, indeed any hospice, is about preparing for the worst possible day that could ever come to any family. But what it does 24/7 is provide the best possible days en route to that moment.
Yeah.
And they like that, reprinted it. I was very proud of that.
And am I not right in thinking Rav had a link with Naomi House as well?
Oh, was this the fake snow?
I imagine there's so much more to it than that.
That's what my husband does for a living. Fake creates fake snow. Yes. Rav did a Winter Wonderland scene for them a few years ago for GMB, I believe.
Yeah, well, they put the pictures up.
Yes.
Or did you put the pictures up? But Naomi came back and said they remember it very, very well indeed. I mean, actually, with all due respect to him, and let's pretend that he's not here.
Right.
But we all know in television, nothing's possible without technicians. But actually, that was exactly what I was talking about. There's nothing that anyone at Naomi can do to stop something that will happen, which is why that young man or woman, and we do teenagers as well as very, very young folk there now, because we also have Jack's Place. But the day before, the week before, the month before can be as magical as your children or our children enjoy as much and as frequently as we can. And his was one of them. And I think that's lovely.
It's also a lesson in journalism where everything coincides at some point, doesn't it? So you know Naomi House, Rav knows Naomi House, and something I'm learning in teaching is that you need to be very careful how you...
Again, thinking about, you know, what is education and education drawing out from the Latin rather than sticking in, and the conversation that we may return to about whether you express your views, this, that, and the other. I think also that journalism is easily forgotten, that it's what happened during the day, that day. Du jour, journalism. And at its best, it is simply an informed and balanced account of events that have happened in the preceding period. But as Clem said, and you were chatting in the introduction, in a way that leaves folk at home to make their own minds up. Mm. Not saying Mr. Johnson did X or Mr. Corbyn did Y or Ms. Swinson did Z, and this is what it really means and it's this, that and the other. No, that's for other folk to decide. We'll just tell you what they did. Mm. And that's my absolute golden rule, and I've fallen out with people over it recently.
I think another massive link between journalism and education is the need for empathy. And I think I've certainly experienced that. It's one of my biggest challenges as a head, I think. You know, being an empathetic teacher kind of comes naturally to you. But as a head, you suddenly realise you take on responsibility for that whole community. So poorly mummies or daddies or teachers that are struggling or children that are going through something you can't manage, to guide a community through an event like that is really, really difficult. And I suppose it's similar in journalism. I always remember watching you when ITV had 24-hour news. And you did the Beslan. I remember you reporting on Beslan. And I think anyone else watching, you would have just thought you were just talking, you know, perfectly normally. But I could tell you were trying not to cry. And it was, there was such a need of empathy there to bring that story to life without over-dramatising it, because it certainly didn't need that, without making it schmaltzy and movie-like. Yeah. It was just pure factual reporting about something extraordinary.
It was staggering, because it was day one at a primary school in Beslan in South Ossetia. And some extremists decided they'd take over the school and make an issue between them and the central Moscow government. And in the end, it ended with stormtroopers going in, and over 100 children were killed, with mummies and daddies waiting outside. And South Ossetia, babushkas as well, grandmas, and they saw it all. Mm. I remember I said to Clem and the others afterwards, one of the reasons that I was able to try and keep a relatively straight face was because I was pinching my thigh all the way through, and it was black and blue when I'd finished. That was the only way I could stop myself from crying. I had a good blub afterwards, though.
Where is that line between, I mean, I'm married to a journalist as well, and it's quite interesting how sometimes he can go to a war zone and come back with his objectivity thoroughly intact, but occasionally there'll be a story. So with us, it was Baby P.
Yeah.
And I believe Rav actually phoned in and said, I can't do this story because
I trace it back to the brilliant Michael Burke, for whom I have the highest possible regard, when he was in Ethiopia and reporting on the events that led to Band Aid and Bob Geldof doing his thing and what have you. And it was Burke saying, on one side of this wall, young people will die. And on the other side of this wall, they have a chance of survival. And it's just down to that. And he began to empathize with that situation. And then John Simpson, who's also another giant, has written about it extensively in his autobiographies that I thoroughly recommend to anybody who's interested in thinking journalism. But I make a huge distinction, and to me it's absolutely vital. I think there is a difference when you are dealing with a humanitarian crisis. It might be Beslan and the children, or it might be Mike with the dying people in Northeast Africa. When it's domestic policy and domestic politics, there is no place for empathy or partiality. Full stop, point final, end, move on.
Do you remember your teachers, when you think about your schooling now, did your teachers show empathy?
Yeah, I was talking to Clem about this. My earliest schooling memory is the taste of cold milk and digestive biscuits, were given. Oh, fantastic. And it was third of a pint. And it was in Scotland, St Andrews, Madras College, which David Steele subsequently went on, and we used to talk about it occasionally. And that's just a kind of taste thing that I just remember very clearly. It's then a bit blurred until I was about 14, 15, and I was at a Roman Catholic boarding school, St Augustine's in Ramsgate. My dad was in the Royal Air Force, so there was no snobbery involved in going to boarding school. It was so you didn't change school every 2.5 years as dad moved around the world and around the country. And it was really weird, because half of the teachers were monks, and Benedictine monks, who, fortunately not Jesuits, who beat 2 tons of understanding out of you. But the Benedictines are great educators, and lay teachers, most of whom, frankly, weren't terribly good. There was a standout lay teacher, and Clem and I have talked about him at great, great length, Robin Edwards, who was my history teacher, who I adored and is still alive. And I've seen him a couple of times recently down in Ramsgate and what have you. And then, but the monks were a mixed bag. But they tended to be intellectuals because that was part of the monastic existence, was study and teaching and what have you. And the absolute standout for me was a chap called Father Aelred Pattinson, who, to cut a long story short, eventually gave up Catholicism, gave up the priesthood, and ended up as head teacher of Frensham Heights. And was on my This Is Your Life program, just a total hero. And he just captured everything we've already been talking about. He never once told me how he voted, which party he favoured. But he urged us all from age 14, 15 to read Animal Farm, to read 1984, to read Brave New World, to read Steinbeck, all sorts of people.
To question.
Absolutely. And I tweeted the other day about if you want to learn, just read. But if you want to understand, challenge and question. And that's what Aelred was utterly brilliant at. And I adore him to this day.
Yeah.
And that's what we say all the time. And I think that's why I feel so strongly that we shouldn't be putting our opinions on people. We should just be teaching them to ask those questions. I'm now going to ask you a question, a direct question, eye to eye. How naughty were you at school?
I don't think I was that naughty.
Well, come on. That sounds like that naughty means there's scope there.
I was rebellious as opposed to naughty.
Examples?
Now, I just hated the fact that it was authoritarian. I hated the head teacher was a brute. I mean, those were the days of corporal punishment, and there was something really weird about him.
Well, tell us more. What kind of corporal punishment?
Classic old-fashioned caning. You argue with somebody, you're late for a class, and that was it. Game on.
With enjoyment?
I think they did. And I'll tell you why. I've spoken to one or two people, I'm in my 60s now, but other people who were involved, because I'm involved with the charity that is trying to save the church that was associated with the school, because it was Pugin, so it's a brilliant piece of architecture. So I bump into people I was at school with who I've not spoken to for ages, and it crops up occasionally, and the real fear that guy instilled. And interestingly, none of us had any recollection of, as it were, classic paedophilia. But we, all of us, remember that brutality and how much we hated it.
Yeah, so my daughter's sitting here, saucer, right? So people, teachers used to be allowed to hit children if children were naughty at school. Do you think that should be allowed?
No.
No?
You're right.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
But was it like...
I mean, I also think it's a complete admission of defeat that if that's the only response that you can come up with, which is why I agree with Clem, I think there was something deeply unpleasant going on in that man's mind as well.
I think it's the 21st century version of that for us is shouting. I do not allow shouting to happen in my school.
They used to throw board dusters and things like that. Yeah. But interesting, the twist to it, which again is something that then has become crucially important to the family. I mean, I love the academic side of it, genuinely adored the academic side of it. But my great release come the weekend was to go sailing and to go horse riding.
Yeah.
And I was taught to ride by a chap called the Captain, who was retired cavalry. And it had a bit to do with sailing and a bit to do with horse riding. It had everything to do with getting the hell out of that place.
Right, right.
And that's so sad.
I actually can't imagine. I do remember, so this would have been the early 80s, I do remember a boy being slapped on his bare bottom in front of the rest of the class in the early mid-80s and just feeling physically sick with how wrong it felt, the humiliation. Because were kids punished in front of the rest of the class or?
No, I don't know. Not that I recall. Possibly at the prep school. But it, again, it's weird. Education, neat segue, but come back to what you want to talk about. In literature, you know, whether it's Oliver Twist or whether it's Tom Brown's School Days, that form of discipline in schools or in workhouses or foundling places, absolute part of the course. And someone like Dickens, who was such a brilliant social campaigner, I mean, he wrote that book partly as a social campaigner. He was also a brilliant political correspondent. He used to do parliamentary reports. I love Dickens. But anyway, but that would almost just go by the by, so that's fine. And Tom Brown's School Days was all about a new theory of private education at rugby school. And yet that kind of discipline was just, nod that through.
But also the fags and the other way the older children treated the younger children, almost this brutal, this Darwinian dog-eat-dog physical strength above all else, which almost negates what you're talking about.
Again, questioning and again, underlining the point we made at the very, very beginning about my impartiality, which I feel terribly strongly about. But when people bemoan the fact that David Cameron and Boris Johnson were both Etonians. I mean, forget about the Oxford bit, because that's a totally different argument, but the kind of school that they went to, it wasn't only about entitlement, it was about social order.
How do you mean?
Well, the fags may have been from the same social class, but when they were 13 and Pop, they called it at Eton, the sixth form, the prefects, were 18, there was that famous sketch, you know, with John Cleese, and they're saying, I'm upper class and middle class, I know my place. I mean, fagging was partly about how people knew their place. When my father was in the Royal Air Force, he had a batman. And the batman was there to make sure his uniform was absolutely fine and polish the buttons and make sure his shoes were right. Social order, structures. Weird.
I always remember a story. Do you remember Zoe Norgrove, my tutor at Twyford?
Yes, I do.
Her husband went to school and he was in a similar situation, and he was sent down to a local hardware store to get a meter of fallopian tubing.
What?
It was a brilliant prank. I remember him telling that and thinking it was one of the funniest things I'd ever heard. That and a tin of tartan paint. And he did it. He walked straight in and asked for it. It's one of my favourite things.
Fallopian tubing.
A meter of fallopian tubing. But what I love is, I think the sort of difference for us is, when I look at my little ones, they come in and they get given a buddy at the top of the school. And that's somebody who becomes their big sister or their big brother. And they're the person that looks after them and teaches them how to skip and join them in playground games. Because when you're four, you don't know how to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And what's so sweet is, because my school goes from 4 to 18, these, you know, big girls, you know, when they're 11 years old in year six, ready to go on into the world, they then go into year seven and they get given a buddy from the sixth form, and history repeats itself again. And I think that shows that seismic shift in our understanding now of teacher empathy, the need for children to have effective well-being and support and nurture, so that people don't sit there in their 60s and talk about that abject fear, that humiliation. And I think that's so important.
Yeah. Another thing I also remember as well, particularly with you and Alex, different story with Fred and Oggy, but that if something was going amiss, you know, whether it was something really quite serious or whether it was just, you know, he or she seems to be smoking or something like that, it kind of became a major crisis. And it was, you know, an 8 o'clock meeting and sitting outside the office and stuff like that. Whereas I would like to think that it's better done. And I know, having talked to Clemmie, no names, no pack drill, because she's equally cautious about all of that, but the kind of episodes nowadays, it seems to be more of a conversation rather than, you know, huge peaks and troughs. It's just things are beginning to crop up here that maybe we as teachers and you as parents and guardians might like to look at. And I, even as recently as 20 years ago, it was don't hear anything, and then suddenly, oh, the world's coming to an end.
Yes.
And that didn't seem to me to be helpful to anybody.
Yes. Part of the punishment at my school was to phone your parent in front of your house parent to tell them what you'd done.
Oh, I still use that one.
I still remember the fear. More powerful
than phoning a parent to say, I'm just going to put you onto your daughter now, and she's going to explain to you
I'm getting the nervous tummy
ache. To her classmate, to demean her in front of the rest of the class. Oh, it's so powerful.
I don't think my education was hugely important to my dad. But I have no recollection at all in my senior school, right up even to choosing university and preparing for interviews and stuff like that, of them being engaged in any way at all with it by the school. We'd talk about it during the vacation, but there was no, you know, they paid their money and then they moved on. And it was almost that attitude of, it's not really got anything to do with them. We're the professionals.
Whereas we're obsessed with parental engagement.
We became that. And certainly with Alex and with Clem, we had, and Beedales were actually stronger about it than Winchester College were, engaging in good conversations at kind of age 16, 17 about what the options were. And I seem to remember at Beedales, there was a particularly good careers advisor woman. And one of the things I feel very, very strongly about is I don't approve of the conveyor belt from secondary school straight into university, because nowadays, yeah, I'm a huge fan and supporter of apprenticeships. I'm a huge fan and supporter of take 2 or 3 years out, go and do something else. Fine. Unless you want to be a lawyer or a doctor, keep your mind wide open and take your time. And Beedales were much better than many schools.
How do you see education today as compared to education when Clemmie was at school or when you were?
One of the huge problems with all politics, I think at the moment, but literally Friday of last week was a new beginning, whatever you think of the outcome of it. that serious matters like education, the health service and what have you, was pretty well put on hold for the best part of 3 years, certainly
See,
2 years.
I still can't help rolling my eyes when you mentioned last Friday. And this is what I mean by finding it really hard to remain impartial. Yeah. And it's because serious matters were put on hold and that makes me roll my eyes. Yeah. This is why
I find it hard. But also because Boris Johnson, you know, get Brexit done was the slogan. Dominic Cummings said that's the thing that we just need to sort out. Therefore, it was one of the thinnest Conservative manifestos in memory. Mm. You know, if you go back to 79 and Margaret Thatcher, and indeed Tony Blair in 97, and 83 in between, which was quite interesting with Michael Foot and what have you. But these were big, chunky, ideological, philosophical documents. The Tory manifesto for this general election was very, very thin in many respects. So, as it were, the game is on. But I think if you trace it, Thatcher herself was an education secretary, briefly, funnily enough, remembered for withdrawing milk from schools.
For her excellent relationships with teachers.
Well, that was same as David Blunkett had a pretty hairy relationship with teachers.
He did,
actually. I think that's one all. But it is extraordinary when Tony famously said education. And Blunkett was his first education secretary, and David Blunkett to me is one of the absolute standout politicians in the post-war period. And yet top of his agenda when he took over in 97 was numeracy and literacy.
Mm.
In 1997, that was the big issue. One of my closest friends in politics is Charles Clark, who did the job for Tony Blair about 5-6 years later. And his absolute priority was accessibility to universities in the first decade of the 20th century.
Yes.
And so it's quite easy to forget that evolution doesn't always work. And sometimes, although people say, take education out of the political arena, make it something that is above, beyond, or outside of politics, you can't do that. Because politicians, we put there to do a job, and we put them there to do the job that we want done. And Tony recognised and David recognised that what ordinary folk wanted there and then was that their little ones would leave school capable of reading and writing. Mm. The CBI was still saying at that time that 25-30% of the young people applying for a basic job could not count and could not write properly. Mm. And that needed to be addressed for their benefit. And that's what parents wanted.
It's still a problem. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work with PRUs, pupil referral units, recently. Some inspirational places, incidentally, Clemmy, where nobody shouts.
Exactly.
The calmest places. Yeah. And these are the children whose needs have been completely unrecognised, unmet.
Why do you think that
system?
Is that a philosophical point or is it pure economics?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I mean, this is in a very privileged area as well, Buckinghamshire.
Yeah. In Buckinghamshire.
Still have selection. So I didn't know there was a PRU in Buckinghamshire. That's how naive I was. I was brought up in Buckinghamshire. I never imagined there was a pupil referral unit. So these are remember the forgotten third who are never going to pass the GCSE.
Sure.
These are the ones who are probably causing the biggest grief in the classroom for the teachers. These are the ones who are probably not, although actually not in all cases, some of them are very bright, but probably not going to get a grade 4 at GCSE, and who don't have the parental support a lot of the time, don't have the parental engagement, whose own parents are very scared by school. But fundamentally, the issue is that, and I always defend teachers and their well-being and their credibility, but actually the teachers have failed to meet these children's needs. Mm. This is a much bigger topic. This is for a whole other podcast. But my sense is that teachers are so busy and so frazzled that some of the most important things have actually fallen off the to-do list.
I, again, as an objective reporter, I find it extraordinary that education doesn't have the same volume of voice that the NHS does.
Mm.
In the political debate, the demand for more resources, reform, and liberalisation, all the rest of it for the health service is always at the top of the hit parade in virtually any election. Education is quite often down at 3 or 4. And yet you're talking, I mean, not everybody is blessed with children, but an awful lot of us are. And apart from our collective health and well-being, you'd have kind of thought that was pretty important.
Do you not think there's a link there, though, between how the public perceive people who work in the NHS and how people perceive people who work in education. And I say that very bravely, and I'm now going to take metaphorical cover. But in terms of, you know, you hear about doctors and nurses, you know, you very, very rarely hear them come under any form of criticism or scrutiny. And if they do make a mistake, it's because they're overworked, they're overtired, which I fundamentally agree with, by the way, before anyone misquotes me. I do think that's really true. However, I think with teachers, it frustrates me how they're perceived by the public in terms of, well, we rock up at 9, we leave at 3, we're on holiday for at least 2/3 of the year, we're overpaid, we don't do a huge amount, and actually the children just roll around in glitter all day.
Is that still a perception?
Yes.
Is it?
Jinx. Yeah.
Because when I spoke to Ed Dorrell, the commissioning editor of the TES, he actually said it's more that people actually feel slightly sorry for teachers. So if you say you're a teacher... That.
I'd like to see his data.
I think it was more perception. But so there is still a perception,
I think it is.
9 to 3 and the weird many thing, holidays.
I mean, John Reid, another great friend in politics, always used to say, if you poll people about the NHS, they'll say it's dreadful. If the second question is, and what was your experience last time you personally or someone in your family used the NHS? Oh, Mark. Marvelous. Oh, brilliant, brilliant. And that makes it quite tricky. But, it's really weird what we were talking about, going back to my school days and attitudes towards discipline and what have you. You can still find the most arrogant consultants in hospitals who don't share debate or discuss. They just tell you. And equally, bossy nurses, male or female, who just tell you what to do and what you can't have. And yet, because they're going to save my life or save my son or daughter's life, you forgive them everything. But you don't put at the top of your political agenda what teachers are going to be doing and what schools are going to be doing. And we end up having what I think are sometimes slightly hollow arguments, as when you talk to Fiona about it, it was far from hollow, but the sort of the academy versus selection versus comprehensive. And it becomes almost esoteric.
Which and when missing someone, the point.
Yeah, well, I think so. And someone like Michael Gove, who, again, I'm lucky enough to know him reasonably well, anyone who thinks that Michael Gove is just a sort of crazy automaton when he was education secretary just got it fundamentally wrong. He was reacting to what he perceived people to have wanted from our schools. And that was, yes, harder work, longer hours, and believable measurements of success and achievement.
So why was
and why did And yet the industry, to a great extent, turned on him.
Mm.
And I'd sat down at Surbiton High School and chatted a brilliant group of people, no names, no backdrop. Yeah. And we had a really brilliant 45 minutes talking purely about that, what was driving Gove and what the reaction was, not from mums, dads and kids,
but from teachers.
But from teachers.
Now, well, I was in a room when Gove resigned. Did he resign or was there a reshuffle? I can't remember.
I think there was a reshuffle.
There was a reshuffle.
And Dominic Cummings was sitting there at the pounding heart of the Department of
and
Education.
And I was in a room of 60 teachers and there was a cheer.
Yeah.
What was at the root of that animosity? Was it simply that teachers just felt attacked again?
I think it's terribly simple. And if you boil it down, what Gove was saying on behalf of his electorate, and one thing politicians never ever forget is they're only there because people vote for them. Mm. I think that cheering might have been was a curious reaction to the fact that deep down they knew what Gove was saying was probably true.
And really?
Get your tanks off our lawn.
Oh, gosh, I've never thought of it
that. I'm old enough to go right back to when Fred Jarvis was the General Secretary of the National Union of Teachers. Brilliant, brilliant man. And Labour, to his pounding heart. But he was practical. Mm. Yeah, we're paid to do a job.
There's a good way of clarifying on this, and that was Michael Gove did agree to come onto this podcast.
And then
a couple of weeks later, the election was announced, and I got a delightful email from, I'm assuming, his secretary saying, unfortunately, he's now unavailable.
Yeah.
The election's now done.
I
would be delighted if Michael would join us.
I bet you a penny to a pound that if you renew that request, you will get it. The only thing he might say is you might want to talk to Gavin Williamson because he's the Secretary of State.
I'd like to talk to Michael Gove first.
Well,
on the hashtag Clement M podcast coming soon, Mr. Michael Gove.
Well, I tell you, she'll now decide whether she's going to explain why. But whenever I see Michael, he always says, and how is your brilliant daughter?
I did do some work experience with Michael Gove.
Did you?
I did.
What did that involve?
So fascinatingly, it involved researching the impact of academisation of failing schools. And this was, I'm just thinking it was either my NQT year or NQT years plus one. So it would have been 2009, 2010, long before I ended up working for a MAT, long before I ended up being a governor of an academy school. And it was fascinating. And genuinely, and again, this is not me showing politics with a capital P, I respected the fact that he was fascinated by the impact of that research, yes, and what it was showing. And what I saw was somebody who just wanted to see what the data was telling them rather than trying to get the data and to push forward their argument.
Let me chip in on that, because again, balance is important. And I hope you noticed, and the people are good enough to listen to our conversation, I've mentioned conservatives and I've mentioned
Labour
people.
I have very much noticed that, yes.
And that does matter. But one standout, and even the ones who screw up occasionally, Steve Byers was someone who became a very good friend, and he was Minister of State for Education. He, and like schools minister, I think it is nowadays. So he either worked for Charles or he worked for David. I think Charles, actually. And I had a long, long lunch with him once, and he said, all your kids were educated privately. And I said, well, yeah, apart from the last one. No, Oggy wouldn't have been around by then. No. So, yes. And that was our choice. And we had an interesting debate about that, because sometimes you do it to purchase class and status, and sometimes you do it because the local schools aren't.
Why did you do it?
Jinx. Can I come back to that? Because I don't want to miss the point. But Steve Byers, who was an academic and a Labour Party local government person before he then got into Parliament and into government, one of his big projects was to try and get state schools and private schools talking to each other more and crossing over. And Manchester Grammar School was a good example, where he was getting staff from Manchester Grammar School to spend time in state schools and vice versa, and cross-fertilise with the kids. He then fell out of politics and what have you. But I still think that that's an area that is well worth pursuing. I think that we chose to have our children educated privately because we were purchasing what I perceived and Sally perceived to be reliable standards and a better teacher-pupil ratio, and we had sufficient disposable income in those days to do it. And I think it's one of the many examples of the enormous influence that Sally's father, who sadly I never met because she was 15 when he died, but he was a very successful businessman, entrepreneur, and education to him mattered. And in my case, my dad was a working class lad, his father was a sergeant in the Highland Infantry, not two pennies to rub together, but education was an absolute priority. And I think it's summed up by simply saying, whether it's private or state, any young person who has a good education is going to have a better set of chances later on in life.
So you felt you were investing in something that was ultimately more reliable.
I think we were, we wanted a motor car and we had enough money to buy what we perceived to be, you know, the Rolls Royce at the time. We didn't have to take what may have been a second choice option. That, you know, fortune is the arbiter of half our affairs.
We Camilla Tominey talked about the fact that she, her own confidence, her pizzazz, her alpha female self, was in to a great extent thanks to her independent school education. Do you think Clemmie would have grown up to be a different person had she gone to a state school?
Great question.
We're getting good at this.
We are.
Impossible, and I'm not evading it. But I'll give you a weird answer to it.
Okay.
Oscar, her little brother, had some issues. He had a physical condition when he was about 8 or 9 that caused some damage to his behaviour pattern. Put it, it's not for me to say publicly any more than that. None of anybody else's business, frankly. But his behaviour patterns became very, very tricky. And the private sector, three schools, big brand name schools, failed him utterly and miserably.
You're angry.
I'm furious about it. Nothing to do with the money. Unprofessionalism, disloyalty and disingenuity. And I shall never forgive them. We then chanced on her advice, Clementine Abigail Mary, Eggers School, where Yvette Cooper attended, up the road in Alton, run by the most brilliant man, Patrick Sullivan. I'm going to get emotional.
That's okay.
And they said, we'll deal with it.
And they did. They genuinely did. So what they did for him, while Dad gets himself together.
State school?
State school, comprehensive, one of only two in Alton. We literally contacted nearly every school. And they basically promised to do a sort of a half-half situation where he would go to school for certain subjects and certain parts of the day, but then the rest of the time he'd go off and do kind of a version of an apprenticeship, but not a full apprenticeship.
It was an absolutely brilliant deal. It was 3.5 days academic.
Yeah.
They wanted him to try and get the 5 GCSEs. He ended up with 3, which is absolutely fine. And then he did a day with Kevin Cooper,
yeah,
with Freddie's girlfriend's yeah. yard, which was a functioning horse yard, because that's his life and it's become his life now, and Half a Day with His Trainer. Mm-hmm. And he's a very competitive, very, very good show jumper now. He's still occasionally a slightly naughty fellow, but that aren't we all?
We were with him last night being naughty.
none of those private schools that I will now, because we're radio, not television, will share, reduce me to tears for 5 seconds, which Clemmy very kindly bridged nicely. My real anger was none of them tried. Mm. If they tried and failed, it's a score draw. Eggers exclusively tried, and brilliantly.
And I think what they then did is, so he then left with his GCSEs, and he then did the apprenticeship, yeah. didn't he?
Yes, British Open.
And what's fascinating...
Advanced apprenticeship in sporting excellence.
He did. And he got so much from it. And it's the first time, I think, in 16, 17 years, I saw that boy with a folder with dividers in it and notes, because he'd finally found something that he valued that mattered to him. And I think what's, of all the people you've spoken to up to this point, one of the most, for me, unexpected links is that of apprenticeships. I think nearly every single person has talked about apprenticeships.
Yes.
And I think that's fascinating. And we met with Tom Tugendhat, didn't we?
Yes.
To talk about this. And the apprenticeship menu needs to improve. I think everyone's in agreement with that, but it has such capacity to be brilliant. What are your thoughts on it, particularly from when we talked with Tom? What were your thoughts?
Oh, I have been wedded to apprenticeships for quite some time, and we, you know, the Careers Week thing as well, which I'm doing for the second year running, which again is just an open folder. You don't automatically think of university, but please, please, please include it on the menu. But look more widely. The Tories, generally speaking, have been into it for quite some time. And one of the standout guys to look up and research is Robert Halfen, who was, I think he was a junior minister in the employment department rather than education. And he's what they call a blue-collar Tory. He's a working-class lad who's become a Tory MP and a Tory minister. But he knows that it makes sense for an awful lot of people. And not only because they may not have the, choose my words very carefully, but the kind of classic intellectual academic reach. You know, Fred, our number three child, number two son, is another classic case. I mean, Fred is absolutely as bright as a button and will see in business deals, see people off left, right and centre. He just doesn't happen to be academic.
Right.
And when Beedale's said there's no place for him in the sixth form, we all lost our tempers again. But he took himself to Alton College, our local sixth form college.
Right.
He did his A-levels. He found the livery yard. He set the business up. He runs it. He works his what's-its off. And he's a huge success. He just doesn't happen to have a degree. But to me, what he's done and what he's got is immeasurably greater.
Mm.
And it suited him. Yeah. So it's open-mindedness. What we're really talking about is, therefore, I hope that all of the people in your profession, particularly careers advisors, take that on board as well, that it is an equal partner on the menu as going to Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, LSE, whatever it may be.
A school that does this brilliantly, it's one of our United Learning Academies called Kettering Buccleuch, and they've got this brilliant principal there, Dino DeSalvo, who's one of my heroes, and I went up to visit the school recently. And they've got this part of the school called the Aspiration Corridor. And the entire corridor is painted like an underground tube map, but every single stop is a different job, different role. And that will range from television presenter, producer, teacher, to plumber, plasterer, train driver. And there's that sense of everything has equal placing. Yes. You know, it's not like a Monopoly board where you're aiming for Park Lane. Yeah. Everything has equal placing and every child is given that opportunity. And yeah, there's a role of honour about who's gone to university, but there's also that sense of everybody can go anywhere they want to go. And I think that's one of the biggest successes in that school is that sense of aspiration and drive. It's an amazing school.
Last year when I did the Careers Week thing and they had a lovely conference in London, which I attended, I wasn't performing, I'm performing this year, but I was just sitting there listening. And two particular speakers caught my eye as a woman from the Merchant Navy Association saying, you know, although we're much smaller than we used to, we have places for engineers, for waiters, for waitresses, for navigators, right up to captains. And the other lot were the British Horse Racing Association. And they were saying, yeah, working in a livery yard, it's hard work, it's grubby work, and it doesn't pay very well, but it's an exciting, and then you may get right up to the top and become a trainer. And one of the other charities that we support is the Ebony Horse Club, which is for disadvantaged kids in the East End of London, Brixton. And one of their lads is going on to a British Horse Racing Association apprenticeship and will be working in a yard.
That is amazing.
Magic circle.
All the pieces come together.
Absolutely magic circle.
Well, tragically, we're coming to an end. But Alistair, if you were a teacher, I can see you as a teacher, actually. If you were a teacher, what kind of a teacher would you be?
And what would you teach?
What would you teach?
I'd love to teach history. My greatest hero, Sir Alistair Burnett, always said, unless you want to be a lawyer or a doctor and you're not sure what to read at university, if you choose to go to university, do history. Because if we don't know where we've been, how on earth can we ever know where we're going? So I think that's the case. And secondly, I would try very much to be Aylred Pattinson Mark to encourage them to read all the best books and question all the arguments. And final thing he used to do, which I just loved, he used to call them pensées, thoughts.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure lots and lots of it. But you'd walk into the classroom at 9 o'clock in the morning after breakfast and there'd be another two up on the wall.
There's like precepts in wonder.
Yes, it is like the precepts in wonder.
What's that mean? And he'd say, you tell me.
Yes! Is there anything that if you took over leading schools, if you were Secretary of State for Education, is there anything you would introduce to the curriculum or you would make sure every child left school either learning about or understanding that they don't currently?
Your big brother... They had a thing called DIV, and when I did my GCSEs, or they were O-levels in those days, there was a thing called General Studies. I don't know if it has survived. And I think that's brilliant to find within the curriculum, right from the word go. You have debates with your littles, as you call them, about the general election and the environment and all these burning issues. I know from my four, who are unique and very different, that their minds are just hungry, they're wide open. And you get as much sharpness on politics out of Oscar as you will out of Alex or Clem or Fred. So to find a period within the curriculum, and Blunkett used to talk about governance and community, and it often crops up. But when they're 18, they're old enough to vote. When they're 16, they're old enough to join the army. When they're 16, male, female, transgender, whatever, they're old enough to make love with the person that they love, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, we very rarely sit down and talk about that stuff in a societal term. We talk about the biology of it and this, that, and the other. So I would try and say, let's have somewhere between general studies and DIV, but as part of the curriculum, not as an option for folk to drift into when they get a bit bored with French, German, or Spanish.
So not the bolt-on once a fortnight PSHE lessons, but actually more fundamental to the curriculum.
And I think, like Aylred Pattinson, that whether you're doing English literature or history or economics, actually, deep down, that's what it's all about. Yeah. What kind of member of society, what place are you going to take in the community later on? That's as much a teacher's job as why dy by dx gives you the answer.
Oh, a little joke to finish on.
What an ending. Where's B?
Deep philosophical reflections and a bit of banter. Love it. A bit like us, eh?
Oh, absolutely.
I love it. Well, look, Dad, thank you so much for having us, but I live here anyway. But thank you for giving us so much
about
time.
Moving in. We've had chocolate brownies. We've got freshly... Are they the popcorn cookies?
Yeah, they're a bit odd.
We've got dogs, we've got cats, we've got horses, we've got donkeys, chickens.
Yes.
And a turtle. Yeah.
Ducks.
And several people.
I know.
So it's been a deeply sociable podcast, and I felt incredibly welcome. And Alistair's one of these people I feel I've met already. But it's been an
lovely
absolute
to see
delight.
You. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to
You're
see
very
you
welcome.
As well. I feel quite exhausted after that in a very kind of satisfied way. There's so much that I feel as if I've got so much to think about. That was quite emotional at times. I think the theme of compassion, empathy, the good a school can do and the damage a bad school can do is really going to stay with me. And thinking about a lot of the more vulnerable children I work with and have worked with, and how easy it is to mess up by failing to stop, to think, to consider, to understand that young person and to have faith.
And I think the responsibility we all have as educators to get it right, to invest that time, thought and effort. And I think if you think, bearing in mind now, my brothers and I range from 37 to 22, And there's still such a strength of feeling around how we were educated, either positively or indeed negatively. I think those conversations must be replicated in houses across the country. For me, a definite link between how teachers feel about themselves and their work and the amount of time they can invest in those areas. And I say that knowing that it's not as easy as that. But I know the best bits of my day are the bits spent with children, one-to-one, or talking to them, or having lunch with them, or seeing how they're going, or, you know, talking them down when they're having a bad day. That's when you know you're really having a difference and making that impact.
Yeah, my favourite days in school recently used to be when I just dropped everything and just went walking.
Yeah,
it was always when I had the most marking to do, but I'd just go and wander around the corridors. I'd go and talk to kids who'd been sent out of lessons, pop into the science office, steal a couple of biscuits, find someone crying in the toilet, see how they were doing. And actually, at the end of that hour, I felt I'd achieved an awful lot more. Yeah. Marking was still there, but yeah.
And I think that goes back to those themes of empathy and thoughtfulness and mindfulness, and just making sure that that's what we are doing. That's our fundamental business. Another big takeaway for me, as I said, towards the end of when we were talking to Dad, is that link of apprenticeships. This is becoming such a big thing. And I just feel like we need to know a bit more about it. I think we need to set ourselves some homework here.
I feel woefully underinformed in that area, actually. I genuinely do, which is quite worrying, given that I had relatively senior roles in schools over the last 6 years. So I think we're going to be looking for some key people to talk to about that and actually doing some proper homework around that as well.
Yeah, so if you're listening to this and you know about apprenticeships, or you've got some strong feelings about how we can really build on that, I know Relentless Optimism, Nick Hurd, is a real expert in this area and someone I'm very lucky to work with on my master's programme. But you know, anybody else out there who's got some thoughts and would like to share those with us, I'd love to know more. I think it's something we need to get our heads around quite quickly.
And equally, if you were forced through the sausage machine and ended up at university when it really wasn't for you, we'd like to hear from you about that as well.
Definitely.
I've got one more question for you, Clemmy, though. We asked your dad and he gave us a slightly lateral answer. So do you think you would be a different person now if you'd gone to a state school rather than an independent school?
That's such a good question. I certainly grew up feeling very aware of the fact I went to a boarding school and other children around me didn't. And I kind of felt guilty for it, but I was certainly aware of it. I think you are fundamentally the product of how you are raised and the people around you. So I think, no, I think I'm a product of being a family like a Stuart. And therefore, I've grown up to question the world around me and have confidence and belief in who I am and the chance to question things that I don't agree with. But yeah, I imagine it might have been slightly different.
And that confidence is going on show in a little bit more than 2 weeks now. Clemmy, what's coming up?
This would be the TED Talk.
The TED
you're referring to.
Yes.
Which, interestingly enough, is about the theme of parenting. The title is Do Snowplow Parent Remove Essential Grit?
What's a snowplow parent?
Snowplow parent is a parent that goes ahead of their child forging a very clean path without any risk of fear, failure or disappointment, and therefore removing any negative experiences for their children.
Ooh, that sounds fascinating. And how are you feeling about the prospect of standing on that stage?
Utterly terrified. But I'll do it.
You will do it. I know you'll do it.
We've prepared.
You're excited as well, though.
I will be. I'm still in the process of memorising it, which is something I've not had to do for a very long time. I think since drama.
Do you literally have to memorise it word for word?
Word for word. And I'm doing it with my boss at Surbiton, Rebecca. So we are memorising it between us. And there's very much a sense of trust that she will remember the bit before me and I'll remember the bit before her. And if that goes to pot, well, God help us.
A bit like
all.
In the school play, when you have someone up there going,
when the innkeeper forgets there's plenty of room, come on in.
Innkeeper jinx.
I think it will be fascinating. I think it will prompt a huge amount of discussion and feedback, negative or positive.
Mum's net.
If
there's anyone from Mumsnet who would like to talk to us about snowplow parenting, we'd love to hear from you.
Join us. It'll be an amazing experience. I'm a big believer in putting on your big girl pants and taking risks and trying things. So
I'm a great believer in big pants too. On which note, I ran 25 minutes this morning without stopping, by the way. I just want to get that on the public record.
I am proud of you. The only slight shadow of that is the fact that I did see your daughter's impression of what that looked like.
And they are scuffling in the background.
And the fact that, there it is, it's like a little old man shuffle to the loo. But But it's nice they're doing it with you, families together. It's all about running. I'm currently doing my marathon training with my husband too. My run does not look dissimilar to yours, but we will get there. By
you're like
by
a
crook.
Gazelle, Stuart.
I'd say more like a hippo wallowing in the mud, but I'm having a lovely time doing it. So look, if any of what we've talked about today's chime with you, do pick up the conversation at the hashtag Clem and M podcast, and do share your reflections. We do discuss them, as you'll have seen at the start of our podcast this morning. So do get in touch and let us know your thoughts.
Absolutely. And it's goodbye from us and the dogs and the people and the chickens and the donkeys. if you want to get in contact with us, you can find me at Emma Kell at Those That Can.
And me at C Stewart SHS. Till next time, thank you.
The Clem and M podcast with Clemmie Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest, Alistair Stewart. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clem and M podcast is a Those That Can production.